Cancunapa.
Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Soy una fábrica de humo, mano de obra campesina para tu consumo. Frente de frío en el medio del verano, el amor en los tiempos del cólera, mi hermano. El sol que nace y el día que muere, con los mejores atardeceres. Soy el desarrollo en carne viva, un discurso político sin saliva. Las caras más bonitas que he conocido, soy la fotografía de un desaparecido, la sangre dentro de tus venas. Soy un pedazo de tierra que vale la pena una canasta con frijoles. Soy Maradona contra Inglaterra, anotándote dos goles. Soy lo que sostiene mi bandera, la espina dorsal del planeta en mis cordilleras. Soy lo que me enseñó mi padre, el que no quiere a su patria, no quiere a su madre. Soy América Latina, un pueblo sin pierna, pero que camina. Oye,
tú no puedes comprar al viento, tú no puedes comprar al sol, tú no puedes comprar la lluvia, tú no puedes comprar el calor, tú no puedes comprar las nubes, tú no puedes comprar los colores, tú no puedes comprar mi alegría, tú no puedes comprar mis dolores, tú no puedes comprar al viento, tú no puedes comprar al sol, tú no puedes comprar la lluvia, tú no puedes comprar.
Tengo mis dientes pa' cuando me sonrío, la nieve que maquilla mis montañas. Tengo el sol que me seca y la lluvia que me baña. Un desierto embriagado con peyote, un trago de pulque para cantar con los coyotes. Todo lo que necesito, tengo a mis pulmones respirando azul clarito, la altura que sofoca. Soy las muelas de mi boca, mascando coca, el otoño con sus hojas desmayadas, los versos escritos bajo la noche estrellada, una viña repleta de uva, un cañaveral bajo el sol en Cuba. Soy el mar Caribe que vigila las casitas, haciendo rituales y agua bendita, el viento que peina mi cabello. Soy todos los santos que cuelgan de mi cuello, el jugo de mi lucha no es artificial, porque el abono de mi tierra es natural.
Tú no puedes comprar el sol, tú no puedes comprar la lluvia, tú no puedes comprar el calor, tú no puedes comprar las nubes, tú no puedes comprar los colores, tú no puedes comprar mi alegría, tú no puedes comprar mis dolores, no se puede comprar un vento, no se puede comprar un sol, no se puede comprar la lluvia, no se puede comprar un calor, no se puede
lo mío es tuyo. Este pueblo no se ahoga con marullo, y si se derrumba, yo lo reconstruyo. Tampoco pestañeo cuando te miro, para que te recuerdes de mi apellido. La operación Cóndor invadiendo mi nido, perdono pero nunca olvido. Oye,
vamos caminando,
aquí se respira.
collapse.
Hello and welcome to After the Collapse. Welcome. The song that you heard just before this intro, we'll get to in a second. But today on the show, we have two guests from Amnesty International. Today we're going to be talking specifically about mining practices in Central and South America, as well as other topics that are related to that. We have in the studio with us Freddy Osorio Ramirez. He's currently co-chair, business and human rights group, Amnesty International, Toronto. He's a former university professor from Columbia. He turned activist in Canada. He has been involved in supporting campaigns for the improvement of international standards for consultation and consent used by the extractive industry. His expertise lies in the promotion of educational and democratic norms in Latin American countries. Welcome, Freddy.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And how are you today?
I'm fantastic. I'm enjoying this fantastic Toronto weather. I'm here to talk about all of the issues regarding the extractive industry and the work that we've been doing with Amnesty International. As you already said, I'm the co-chair of the Business and Human Rights. And yeah, I'll talk about that later.
Excellent. And Tara Skur is Amnesty International Canada's business and human rights campaigner. Since 1993, she has worked with social justice movements in Central America on issues related to human rights defenders and corporate accountability. In 2006, she joined Amnesty's business and human rights team, and in the last few months participated on two Amnesty International research missions to Guatemala to investigate the impact of extractive industries on Indigenous peoples. She no longer wears the Canadian flag on her backpack while traveling there. I should note that you're calling in from Vancouver.
That's right.
Well, thank you for joining us. You chose the song that we opened the show with, which is called Latino America by Calais 13. What's significant about that song for you?
The song ends with some lines: you can't buy my life, you can't buy the wind, you can't buy the sun, you can't buy the rain, my land is not for sale. And to me, this song by Kaid Vese just exemplifies the spirit of resistance that I have been able to see throughout Latin America, and just that pride, that strength in cultural identity, and the resistance to selling the land and selling off their future and their future generations' livelihoods. And I think it's just such a powerful and beautiful song that, to me, symbolizes that struggle. And if people haven't seen the video, I'd encourage you to check it out on YouTube. It's just spectacular.
I did do that, and I thought it was very powerful. So thanks for introducing us to that song.
Thanks for playing it.
Well, thank you for telling us about the song. Jim Vernon is in the studio as well, as always. Jim, you have something to say?
Sure. So maybe we'll start, Tara, just by putting something of a human face on what we'll talk about more theoretically in a minute. Just to let people know who might not be aware, on June 13th, a woman named Yolanda O'Kelly was driving home after participating in a protest outside of a mine site in San Jose del Golfo, which is about 35 kilometers from Guatemala City. She approached her house, two men on a motorcycle cut across her path and fired at her with a pistol. She was hit by a bullet that lodged close to her liver, while three other bullets hit her vehicle. Now, she was an activist and leader of the organization Northern Front of the Metropolitan Area, protesting a mine site known as El Tambor, operated by Exmiqua, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Canadian company Radius Gold. So maybe we could start off by talking about, specifically in Guatemala, what are the local conditions that have led to events like this happening recently?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad that you've started out by mentioning Yolanda's case. And it's important to mention that Yolanda fortunately has survived the attack. But unfortunately, it's the realization of one of the greatest fears that she expressed to us when an Amnesty International delegation research mission met with her in May. She told us that she was afraid that when she left the interview and was on her way home that she would be shot that very night. But she also told us that, you know, because she feels so strongly about defending the community and defending the rights of her children to a future with, you know, a healthy environment and clean water, that she was going to continue in her struggle. So, you know, we meet many human rights defenders in the course of this work, and it hits home when someone you've recently spoken to, who's such an amazing leader and example of all the good things that we see in the movement, is attacked and hurt. And we're just very, very grateful that she has survived this attack. And Amnesty International and others are calling for the state to investigate the shooting and to bring the perpetrators of the attack to justice. We'll be following this case very, very closely in the days and weeks ahead. I guess it's also important to mention, you know, Freddie and I were talking about this when we were preparing for this interview, to talk about, you know, how many people have been attacked in the last few years, and, you know, we came up with quite a lengthy list, unfortunately, of community leaders who have been shot, attacked, killed, threatened, or harassed over the last few years. And I think it's also important to mention that just on June 16th, 3 days after Yolanda was shot, two other human rights activists in Mexico, in Oaxaca, were also shot. And they are activists in the context of another Canadian mining operation, protesting another Canadian mining operation. There have been people that have been attacked over the last 5 years.
How much news is that, actually? How much coverage does an event like that get? Maybe I'll ask Freddie.
Sure. It's never enough. It's never enough. The life of someone doesn't have a price, and the coverage is never, never enough, never enough. We hear about the cases, and you keep on hearing of cases after case, and you keep on seeing a trend of bodies piling up. It's very sad to see the situation that human rights defenders all over the world have to face just for opposing an economic development project such as a mine. Among the list that we were, the unfortunate list that Tara and I were making in the preparation for this program, we also included this very famous human rights defender from Nigeria, Ken Saro-Wiwa, that was killed in 1995. Mm-hmm. We also included somebody that is very close to Amnesty International, Kimi Pernilla Domico. That's a human rights defender from Colombia. He actually came to Canada twice. Amnesty International participated in bringing him here to talk about economic development issues. He was an indigenous leader. He was opposing a dam in the Sinú River in Colombia, and because of his opposition, he ended up being killed. He went to Parliament here to talk about the issues that his community was facing. Pretty much they were facing issues regarding their livelihoods. The dam was threatening to stop the migration patterns of fish, so that they will not have anything to eat after a while. And they were very concerned about that. And the dam. At the end, he was killed. He was actually kidnapped in 2001, and we don't know yet where his body is, and we don't know what happened to him. And Amnesty International, alongside other organizations, have been asking for clear process and really understand what happened with Kimi.
How many of these attacks and murders are actually solved?
How many are solved? How many perpetrators are brought to justice?
Exactly.
It's such an incredibly tiny number of people are ever prosecuted. And, you know, alternatively, we see on the other hand in Guatemala, but in other Latin American countries, what we call the criminalization of dissent. So where the state has responded quite strongly to company requests or to lay charges against human rights defenders when human rights defenders have been attacked themselves or have filed complaints about threats or harassment, those complaints often don't go anywhere. They're not taken very seriously or they're not prosecuted. So we have a lot of concerns about the way that that is playing out. We're not seeing the people responsible for the human rights violations against human rights defenders being prosecuted, and alternatively, we're seeing vulnerable community members themselves prosecuted for defending their rights.
And are there specific groups that are generally thought to be responsible for these things?
Generally thought to be responsible for the attacks?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that the human rights defenders that we've been speaking to and meeting with have told us is that often one of the social impacts of an unwanted development project in their territory is to create divisions, social divisions between people and communities, between people who are for or against the project, or you know, people who may have jobs working on the project as opposed to people who, you know, don't want the project there. And that just the existence of an extractive project or a development project can sometimes exacerbate existing social tensions. And so sometimes it's very difficult to tell, you know, who exactly is pulling the trigger. Sometimes people are caught. There have been some cases where arrests have been made or people have been identified. But it's proven to be quite quite difficult.
So as Amnesty International representatives, when you're in these countries and you're dealing with this kind of situation, what is your role? Let me start with Freddie.
Well, our role mostly is to highlight community struggles and whatever their voices. We don't have a hidden agenda or anything like that. When we go to these kind of countries, which Canada, you should count Canada as one of those countries that Amnesty International goes to. When we go there, we just try to highlight the voices. We just want to bring their voice and bring it from a smaller scale to a larger scale so people can inform and can engage with this issue.
How do you build the trust with those people? Because I can't imagine you're entering a situation that is very welcoming.
Well, most... Sorry, Tara?
No, go ahead. I'll continue after you.
Yeah. Well, mostly people approach Amnesty, actually. And Amnesty responds from there, and they follow their own... Amnesty follows its own regulation regarding which cases to pick, which cases to select, and which is... There's not enough base to do anything about. But you have to... It's pretty much Amnesty's reputation what precedes. You know, they know that Amnesty doesn't come up with skewered or weird investigations. Researchers in Amnesty are very well known for their accuracy. And because of that accuracy and because of all of this history that Amnesty has, we have this reputation with people. So they come to us and they ask to take a couple of cases.
And I completely agree with you, Freddie, and just to add that our role is to understand the context and what led to the human rights violations, specifically within international human rights frameworks. Our role is to speak to all sides and to get the most accurate information possible. And our challenge, of course, is to ensure that the information we're being provided is correct and verifiable. And then in all cases, we endeavor to be as transparent and accountable to human rights defenders as possible. So the reason that we're able to enjoy the trust that we do, and we can't ever overestimate the amount of trust that we have in any organization as an outsider, but the amount of trust that we do have is based on being very honest and transparent with the human rights defenders we're meeting with about what we can and can't do. Often, you know, our role is very defined to make recommendations to host governments, what we call the government that's the country that's hosting an extractives project, for instance, the host government. We call the home state the country of where the company is based. So often our role is, in these extractives cases, is to make recommendations to the host state, say, for instance, Guatemala or Colombia, to the home state, which would be Canada. and to the companies involved. And we just try to be as clear as we can about what we expect those recommendations, what we expect our role to be, but also to try and make sure that when a human rights violation has taken place, the recommendations that we make are in line with the aims of the communities themselves, so we're not undermining their own strategy, and we're not in any way undermining their rights.
And so getting back to the context, say, in Guatemala and Colombia, which are the two cases we'll talk mostly about today, what are the political conditions that lead extractive industries to produce both the kinds of conflicts you see, the kind of resistance you see, and the kind of repression of the resistance that one finds? Are there similarities, differences across Guatemala and Colombia, or across Latin and Central America, or are there, is it unique case by case, or?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen over the years that, you know, about 20 years ago, Amnesty began to start addressing the underlying issues behind some of the attacks on human rights defenders and began to notice that many of the reasons for the attacks related to violations of economic, social, or cultural rights. So people such as the villagers in Niger Delta were standing up to companies and states that were ignoring or trampling on their rights, and in some cases these activists were being threatened or injured and killed. And in that time since, we've seen an ever-expanding growth of international trade agreements and investor rights through, you know, bilateral and multilateral trade agreements as states try to fuel their own economic growth. But at the same time, we've seen that human rights laws and standards haven't kept pace with this expansion of trade and this desire for foreign direct investment. And this has certainly been in the case of Guatemala, which is the example that I can speak to. The Marlin mine, which is owned and operated by Goldcorp, which is a Vancouver-based mining company, it's the largest development project to take place in the country in 20 years. A massive project of a massive long-term scale, and in the conditions in Guatemala are such that there's a lack of experience in the country in dealing with a project of this size, dealing with an extractive sector project of this size, and often these projects are sold to companies on the basis that Canadian companies have experience in the extractive sector. We can help you sort out your environmental regulations. We can help sort out financing. We have great relationships with Aboriginal peoples in Canada, and you know, we can manage this project for you.
Tara, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Hi. Sorry about the technical difficulty, and I apologize to people that were waiting for Rebel Music. We've usurped them unintentionally, but we had made arrangements for this time through Radio Region, so Rebel Music will start at 8 o'clock, so again, apologies, and I can only assume that you have been actively enjoying After the Collapse while you were waiting for Rebel Music, which explores the connection between economic exploitation and social injustice, and we are here with Freddy Osorio Ramirez and Tara Skur, and I'm sorry, Tara. I've heard you call yourself Tara.
Yes.
Okay, good. I've been saying Tara, I just want to make sure
I got
that right. Excellent, yes. So, why don't we start off where we left off?
Sure. We were talking about the expansion of economic rights and the protection for certain companies and how that expansion hasn't translated into an expansion of human rights and the protection of human rights. So there are certain things and certain powers that countries give to companies. One of those, for example, it's a very complicated issue, that it's the state company arbitration panels. These are located in Washington, and the idea is that they have to separate pretty much is that a company can sue a government for future profits lost because of the policy of that country. So one wonderful example of this, one very recent example of this that can be, just to give a little bit of specifics of what Tara was talking about, so we can give it, you know, it's important to have this. there's in Germany was trying to change a little bit their energy policy, and this company Vattenfall, a Swedish company, sued them for something like $2 billion because of the change of energy policy, because they would make that much money using nuclear power, and Germany is, well, Germany's counselor, she said that, first lady actually, she said that they are trying to change the direction because the risks that are involved in getting energy from nuclear reactors after all that happened in Japan and so on. So those are like the cases that you see.
And these are policies that companies can enforce as a result of trade agreements between countries?
Yes, free trade agreements usually, yeah. That's pretty much.
And so timely, because Canada has been pushing to be involved in this new trade agreement or existing trade agreement, TPP, is it? In Central Asia or
Pacific Rim,
yes. When a trade agreement like this comes on the horizon, does Amnesty International get involved to try to safeguard against these potential exploitations of justice?
That's an excellent question. Amnesty is not against free trade agreements, and that's the first point that we have to address. We are not saying no to trade agreements. What Amnesty is doing, for example, in the case of the free trade agreement between Colombia and Canada, is understanding how all of this money that is coming, all of this investment that is coming into Colombia, is going to make a situation that is dire, is going to make it worse. So that is a little bit of what Amnesty is doing. Once again, as Tara already said, we're trying to understand the context and highlight how, in the context of what's going on in that specific country, things might get even worse because of this kind of investment.
For example, in the case of Colombia, while we haven't opposed a free trade agreement, as Freddie said, we have asked for an independent human rights assessment to be done. And as a condition of signing on to the free trade agreement, the Standing Committee on International Trade agreed to this, but they haven't complied. And so the issue would be, you know, what is the human rights context in which these investment and trade decisions are being made? How would signing a free trade agreement, which would essentially open up the economic sector to foreign investment, impact on the human rights and the daily lives of the average person in Colombia? The same could be said for Honduras and other places as well. And so that's where what we're asking the Canadian government to do is to really be clear and transparent about the human rights impact of these trade agreements.
I don't know if there's a typical example, but in my mind, just from my awareness of the issue, not being an expert at all, I imagine a company, and it seems that maybe it's because we're in Canada that Canadian mining companies tend to have a bit of a reputation, but it seems that a company will go into another country, let's say in Central America, let's say Guatemala, and extract a valuable resource and make a lot of money from it. And a lot of people that are involved in the mining of it, the people in the towns that are being mostly affected, don't seem to be benefiting from the amount of money that's being made on these resources. And in terms of a trade agreement with countries, what benefits are there in these other countries? Like, what are the economic benefits that these countries are getting from foreign mining companies coming in and extracting these resources?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I should just point out for your listeners, and they can look this up, on Friday, June 15th, in the Vancouver Sun, the business section, Section D, the front page of that section, they printed the top 100 compensation packages for CEOs in BC. And on the front page, you'll see Charles Jeunesse, the president and CEO of Goldcorp, his compensation package in, I believe it was 2011, was $11,320,000+. And the list, I have the paper right here, you can hear it in my hand, There are 100 names listed, and almost all of them are in the extractive industry. The highest paid former president on the list is John Mackin, the former president of Ivanhoe Mines, that was in partnership with the military dictatorship in Burma, in Myanmar, for a number of years. And his total compensation package was over $23 million. The average mine worker in a place like San Miguel Ixtoacan, where the Marlin mine is making an average of 3,000 to 4,000 quetzales a month, which is, you know, a lot higher than one might get doing subsistence farming, but really translates only to several hundred dollars a month, less than $1,000 a month, to do very dangerous mining work.
With benefits?
Well, there is reportedly, now when Amnesty International was in Guatemala this year, we asked repeatedly for access to the mine to be able to verify this information, and were just denied access, despite the company saying publicly at its shareholders meeting in April that anyone who wanted to come and tour the mine site was welcome, that they were very open and transparent and pleased to show people around. So they didn't let us in, so we can't verify this. But according to the company, there are health services that are available in the mine for their workers and their workers' families. Again, it's unfortunate that we weren't able to go and verify that ourselves. We've just hosted some guests from that community in Vancouver during our annual general meeting. From this community and from another community, and what we've been told is that some of the benefits that are promoted overseas or in the media in Guatemala about having this mine present aren't actually real, they aren't actually happening. So someone gave the example that the company will go into a community and offer free paint so the school can paint the walls. And then they'll offer, you know, the color paint of the company logo, and then claim that they have built a school or funded schools. From that up to, you know, the health benefits and increased prosperity. But what we've been told in this particular case also from human rights defenders, and what we went to verify, is that for example, people will believe that because there are some jobs in the community from the mine, that they can then hike the prices up of basic goods. So what we've been told is that basic goods that used to be, you know, more affordable several years ago are now no longer affordable because of this perception that people in the community have a lot more money.
Well, maybe just on the issue of the kinds of benefits that might accrue when Canadian companies go abroad. Canadian companies do benefit substantially from federal diplomacy and funding in order to gain access to the projects. And so what restrictions are put on companies operating under the banner of Canada by the federal government, if any? We know that Bill C-38 takes most of the regulations away from Canadian companies operating within Canada. So maybe, Freddie, you could speak to the issue of limits or restrictions or help that the federal government gives these companies?
Let's start with the help. One of the things that we've noticed and that a lot of people have noticed is that Canada is using the Canadian International Development Agency, CEDA. They're using funds from CEDA to lobby in different countries for changing the legislation regarding mining. So, for example, I know the case of Colombia. I also know that they intervene in Chile. And there has been reports about Guatemala. So what they do is they fund lobby groups, so they can change. And they call this as some sort of advice to these third world countries, to developed countries, to help them. So instead of building school, instead of creating development, instead of helping people, what the money is being used is to lobby and to give benefits to these companies, to make better conditions for these companies to come in and just take the minerals out.
So the Canadian government had a real opportunity in 2007 to really put Canada at the forefront of corporate accountability in the world and to become a real leader in corporate accountability. There was a process that started in around 2005 that was set up by the Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs and International Trade to examine some of the reports of human rights violations that were taking place in the context of Canadian mining projects. That committee then recommended that a roundtable made up of industry and civil society be set up to study the issue further and to make recommendations. And in 2007, the roundtables on corporate social responsibility tabled an unprecedented report which gave a series of recommendations to the government, unanimously agreed upon by industry and civil society, about how Canada could improve its corporate social responsibility performance and respond to these issues of corporate accountability. The government sat on that report for a couple of years, and then what resulted really wasn't worth the wait. It was what they call building the Canadian Advantage Strategy, which is a four-pillared approach to corporate social responsibility. And you can find this information on the government's website under corporate social responsibility. But essentially, they put in place a number of pillars that just continued to promote voluntary compliance with corporate social responsibility standards. And one of the things that they agreed to do is to fund host country capacity building initiatives, so workshops and that sort of thing. From the evidence that we've seen so far on, you know, according to reports on the government website, most of those workshops that take place focus on helping Canadian companies enter into markets in host states or helping Indigenous peoples, local Indigenous peoples and communities learn how the Canadian extractive sector operates so they can better negotiate deals. We haven't seen evidence of the Canadian Embassy, for instance, or the Canadian Trade Commissioner giving workshops or providing resources for information about how communities can defend and protect their human rights.
You know, if you go to, because I did this, if you go to some mining websites, you'll find lots of examples on those sites about how they're helping communities. If you Google information looking to see how people are affected by mining companies in other countries, you often get the mining websites themselves and talking about what they're doing to help them out. Amnesty International, though you're always looking at facts, I imagine are generally considered quite critical, and I'm wondering if that exposes Amnesty International to lawsuits or pushback from these companies.
Well, as Freddie alluded to earlier, we're very, very careful in our research to make sure that we have all the facts that we can get, that we can verify the information, and that what we say can be proven or backed up, or that, you know, a reasonable connection is being made based on the evidence that we have and the stories that we're being told. There have been situations in which the company hasn't liked what we've had to say and has considered us critical. But I think, you know, it's important to say, just as we don't take a position on free trade agreements, we also don't take a position for or against mining. And that may be surprising to some of your listeners, but we don't actually take a position to say mining is good or mining is bad. Well, where we do take a position is we look at how an extractive project has been implemented in a community and whether or not that project has taken place under international frameworks that respect human rights. So, for instance, has a community given its free, prior, and informed consent? Were they given enough information before an activity was initiated to know what the impacts of the activity would be? Were they given all the information about kind of the scope and range of risks and given the opportunity to have meaningful participation in a discussion about it, to have their concerns heard, to be able to you know, raise concerns and suggest mitigation measures? Or were they given the opportunity to say no? And no can take a number of forms, such as, no, we don't like this method, no, we're not interested right now, no, how about under these conditions, or we absolutely do not want to have extractive activities in our territory. That's what consent implies, mm-hmm. The ability to say no. Consent isn't just about informing people what's going to happen in their land.
So
those are the kinds of things that we look at to determine whether or not a project is proceeding, an economic project is proceeding in a way that fully respects the human rights that people enjoy.
On that note, Jim has an example a bit closer to home that we wanted to bring up.
I was just going to ask perhaps Freddie about the Mistassini Cree in Quebec. Have been under heavy pressure in the last decade to allow an increase of uranium exploration on their land, and have just within the last 2 weeks called not only for a moratorium on their project, but on uranium mining across the province of Quebec and across Canada. I just wonder if has Amnesty is Amnesty involved in cases involving local indigenous communities and their resistance to mining projects? Northern Ontario, Northern Quebec, and those regions?
Yes, Amnesty is involved, but not specifically in that case in Quebec. Actually, now that we're going to be talking closer to home, I just want to give you a couple of the examples that we came up from the list. In 1995, a First Nation activist, his name was Dudley George, he was shot and killed by police in Iperwash Provincial Park. He was protesting against a mining project that was happening on burial and treaty grounds. He's unfortunately dead. Also the Mategami First Nation and the flooding of their land for a dam as well, another issue. But the case that Amnesty took from all of these different resource development issues was the Lubicon Cree. That was an oil spill that happened in 2011, that a pipeline spilled 4.5 million of liters of oil into wetlands. That's land that is traditional of the Lubicon Cree in northern Alberta. So Amnesty started this campaign asking for cleanup, proper compensation, and consultation for future projects. At the end, we were asking the same that we've always asked, independent assessments of ongoing monitoring of the health and environmental impacts of the spill, full access to the site so that they are able to document the spill for themselves. Just to give you an idea, the spill happened, but community was prevented from accessing the land to really understand what was going on. They said, you can't enter, you can't enter. They did not let people in. So we were asking for them to access. And a health team also to be sent to the community to address concerns about different symptoms, including headaches, nausea, community members were experiencing by that time. At the end, the campaign was partially successful because communities were compensated, but communities were not happy. Communities are still asking for full details on the project, and they're asking for future projects to reveal all details of the process, of how they're going to do it, of what contingency plans they have, and what kind of measures, counter preventive measures they have as well.
So maybe in the few minutes we have left, before we pass it off to Rebel Music, we could talk about what people can do to get involved in these issues, both nationally and internationally. Maybe we'll start with you, Tara, and then go to Freddie.
Sure. Well, we have a number of ways in which people can get involved. The simplest one is just going to our website, www.amnesty.ca/business, and you can read there the urgent action around Yolanda O'Kelly, and just get a sense of how Amnesty's business and human rights program is approaching these issues. And so we are starting to do more of our activism online through our Facebook page and through our Twitter account. So, for instance, when Goldcorp's AGM happened in April of this year in Timmins in Northern Ontario, we had a great online petition. We had over 5,000 people sign the petition in less than a week. We had a Twitter feed that went back and forth with Goldcorp. We had stuff on our Facebook page, so there are those kind of more dynamic ways that people can get involved. But we also encourage people to have public, visible actions. So we had a demonstration in Toronto in front of Goldcorp's office, and we had a great evening event the night before where people signed banners and actually voted. We had a mock shareholder vote in which we took ballots on the shareholder resolution that was going before the company. But there are also local groups in Toronto. There's a fantastic business and human rights group, which Freddie co-chairs, that meets regularly, and he can probably talk to you a bit more about that. And there are also used to be a business and human rights group in Vancouver and in Calgary. So there are options for people to get involved that way as well. And I should also mention that we have commissioned a fantastic photo exhibit by an amazing young photojournalist named James Rodriguez. His website is mimundo.org, mimundo.org. And he has put together a photo exhibit for us called Canadian Mining as Development, Myth or Reality. And that's going to be touring across the country in September. And it'll give people a view onto the ways in which Canadian extractive industries are taking place throughout Central America. So that may be one way for people to get connected and to learn more about the issues and bring their energy and their creativity and enthusiasm to our campaign.
Yeah, I mean, if people are in Toronto and want to take action, want to participate, want to know more about these kind of things, you're more than welcome to contact us and the Business and Human Rights Group in Toronto. We have a Facebook page of our own, but also we share the resources with the Canadian office. We meet the second Thursday of every month at Amnesty's office. We usually meet at 7 p.m. You can go to the website aito.ca to find more information about anything in Canada. There are also different groups that you can join, but I really encourage you to join the Business and Human Rights Group. We're a bunch of great people. We just get together every month and we talk about issues. We usually have guest speakers. So topics that we have talked about before includes the Niger Delta, includes the mining in Guatemala, on all of the actions that we did, as Tara was saying, regarding Goldcorp's AGM and the demonstration outside Goldcorp. There's an ongoing campaign for stop the trade of small arms, as well as small weapons. And yeah, there's all kinds of groups as well. There's a film team. There's a couple of events coming here in Toronto. You can find all that information in www.aito.ca.
Most importantly, Freddie, I've heard that you guys have cake and all kinds of really good snacks at your meeting.
We do.
Shame I don't live in Toronto.
Yeah, we have people that bake, and sometimes people bring things.
He was very surprised we didn't have any snacks here.
Okay.
Oh,
he actually commented on that. So we're getting basically to the end of our time. So Jim and I...
Yep, we'll just say we'll post links to all those on the Twitter and Facebook feeds over the weekend.
Yes. We'd like to thank you both for taking the time to be here with us. You do very important work, so thank you. And Tara, I'm just basically going to hang up on you, so I'm sure I'll get an opportunity to thank you later, but thank you on the air. And with that... next up is Rebel Music, and this was After the Collapse. Thank you.
Thank you.